Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Well, there was a small blow struck for freedom in that war last night when, I'm very proud to say, the Center for Security Policy was privileged to honor Senator Ted Cruz and, nine or so patriots from his great state of Texas as part of a celebration not only of the senator but of his state, in addition to several heroes of Hurricane Harvey, all exemplary individuals who are very much in the forefront of protecting us, protecting our freedoms. And I am so pleased that among the company that night was Diana West, one of our featured guests here at Secure Freedom Radio. Also a great patriot and freedom fighter, and one whose counsel we seek each week with great, great expectation. And Diana, I wanted to say thank you for joining us and to invite you to give our audience a reflection on the occasion of the Keeper of the Flame dinner last night with Ted Cruz and company.
Oh, it was a spectacular event, and I am thrilled to have been able to participate. And Senator Cruz's speech was excellent, particularly in his discussions of the hurricane and the can-do spirit that he saw all around Texas, and further his discussions of our problems with willful blindness and our need to more and more and more get committed to truth tellers, get committed to telling the truth about all of our problems facing us.
And in particular, he was very focused on the failure of truth-telling, the outbreak, if you will, of willful blindness. In fact, it's institutionalization, really, the U.S. government, with respect to what I think of as Sharia supremacism and specifically the Muslim Brotherhood. You have been very, very focused on this problem for a long time. Did you find what he said about that particularly noteworthy, Diana West?
Well, I do, because this is at the crux of our problem. It's a chronic problem, and it is even more in our focus as we see how little understanding there is at the highest levels of leadership in intelligence and security and political circles and media circles of the very concept of subversion itself, whether it's Muslim Brotherhood subversion, Islamic penetration, or communist penetration, or Russian collusion or subversion. These terms that we hear thrown around and indeed highlighted and investigated in congressional committees, and for the most part, there is very little understanding of what is even under discussion. And I think in some ways, it's not just willful blindness. I think that we have been blinded, and this goes back to what you and I have been discussing for some years now that I learned so much about when I was researching my book, American Betrayal, which has to do with the destruction of truth tellers and the silencing of truth tellers. And we saw that all through efforts, fine efforts, stellar efforts in Congress and elsewhere to unmask the communist penetration that had become chronic in the 1930s and 40s, and how we look back and can see the truth tellers and investigators into these matters having been effectively eliminated from our historical understanding, our political understanding. So when we're looking at Muslim Brotherhood penetration or the Saudi influence network or what have you, or trying to understand to what extent Russia is still influencing and corrupting our system, which it is.
Diana, your book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character, is, I fully agree, a foundational document, and commend it to all of our listeners as something that really informs and makes clear what we've been up against. You talk about it as a chronic problem. It's a systemic failure to perceive or even comprehend that people who are organized and disciplined and assiduous in the use of tools like subversion are a mortal threat to a polity like ours. It's stunning that after all these years, you go back to, I believe it's 1933, to indicate that this began in earnest with the Roosevelt administration and the Soviet Union as a partnership. But it persists, if not exactly at the state level. There's probably some arguments that it is at the state level, but certainly in terms of non-state actors inside the wire of our government. Senator Cruz talked specifically about the Muslim Brotherhood. Connect some of those dots, if you would, for us.
Yes, well, I think one thing I didn't realize until more recently that I actually was looking at in the research process and was really the formative institutions of the what we are trying to understand and talk about as the deep state. The deep state institutions and bureaucracies and agencies had to start somewhere. And when we go back to the 1930s, we see the explosion of agencies and government itself during the Depression years, during the Roosevelt administrations. And it is out of these kinds of trap doors, they called them back in the day, so many of these bad actors were able to enter into the system and create the system. So the framework for what we're looking at today goes back that far. But what the biggest problem is, and it goes back to willful blindness and also unwillful blindness or the act of having been blinded, there is no consciousness that there can be domestic enemies, there can be domestic penetration. And this, again, is a fantastic and time-proven tactic of the left, of the totalitarians, to essentially neutralize anyone who sees what's really going on, and certainly to, in effect, undermine or remove the rest of the polity's even comprehension that such a thing can exist. And when we go back, there's a very fascinating moment in the dissolution of the Soviet Union when one of the chief propagandists, a man named Arbatov, actually was discussing, this was in the early 1990 period, discussing how the Soviet Union was going to remove the concept of an enemy. And this is actually a real thing. It's quoted, it's stories about it. I've heard him on tape say this. It's a fascinating concept. If you remove the consciousness that there can exist an enemy, you have not just willfully blinded your enemy or your opponent, you have taken him out of the game. And I feel like that's kind of where we are, even to this day, with, of course, notable exceptions. But this is a real crisis, really, of just education and comprehension and historical knowledge.
Right. So when the Soviet Union went away, as we're told it did, and was transformed into the Russian Federation, the enemy went away as well. It seems we stopped thinking of it as an enemy at the very least, and that image was perpetuated even after it became clear, especially with the rise of Putin, that it was basically just being reorganized and continuing to do very much earnest many of the very dangerous things that had been a problem in the past. The last thing, Diana West, I just wanted to very quickly ask you about is, I think it's now becoming an interesting subject of conversation, is that there really isn't a totalitarian right, that those who have been described as that, Nazis, notably, fascists, or really socialists or national socialists, if you will. So they too are of the left. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that. And I was quite shocked to see Congressman Schiff from the House Intelligence Committee actually saying that the concept of an independent counsel to look into the countless Obama and Clinton scandals that we've been discussing is a greater threat to our democracy than anything else, including Russia. When you actually realize that what he is upholding is this notion of no accountability for the leadership class, which is exactly the hallmark of a totalitarian society. Call it our democracy if you like, but that is indeed what would be perpetuated if you do not have accountability and a reckoning in the legal sphere.
It's worth noting that Adam Schiff is a man of the left as well, and a rather colorful one at that. Not well understood, but duly noted here. Dinah West, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. Thank you so much for joining us last night and for joining us again today to talk a bit about it and some of the insights that came from Senator Cruz's comments. They will all be available at securefreedom.org very shortly. Folks, check it out there. Dinah, in the meantime, stay well. Come back to us again very soon. Fred Flights, a colleague of ours at the center, will join us next to talk about Iran and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Fred Flights is in the house, at least virtually. Fred is, of course, the Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs at the Center for Security Policy these days. He is a man who brings a wealth of experience with the intelligence community to his assignment, notably as an analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency for nearly 20 years, also as a member of the staff of John Bolton's organization. I consider it to be the America desk at the State Department back in the George W. Bush administration. Fred served as John's chief of staff, also as a professional staff member on the House Intelligence Committee. He is the author most recently of Obama Bomb, the Dangerous and Growing Nuclear Fraud. It's great to have him with us, always. Fred, thanks so much for your time.
Good to be here, Frank.
So, you too were at our dinner last night as one of the senior members of the center's staff. Just was having a wonderful reminiscence of it with Dinah. Any thoughts you'd like to share with our audience about the Keeper of the Flame dinner 2017?
Frank, these dinners are a special experience for me. I attended these dinners for 25 years as a government employee, and I saw awards given to people like Ambassador Jean Kirkpatrick, posthumously to CIA Director Bill Casey, to Ronald Reagan, who wasn't able to attend at the time because he was ill, Donald Rumsfeld, John Bolton, General Jack Keane, Judge Gene Tiro, and Senator Cruz was such an excellent addition to this group of American heroes the center has represented over the years. He really is someone who speaks for himself, who does the right thing, who does not worry about conventional wisdom. America is so lucky to have him. Texas is so lucky to have him in the Senate, and I'm so glad that the Senate recognized him last night.
Well, I was too. It's really an honor for us as well. Fred, let me ask you about some of the issues you're following that are of concern to all of us, I think, or should be. North Korea. Donald Trump, of course, was in South Korea last week. I think since we last talked, he made a major address to the South Korean parliament about the North. He also spent some time in China talking to the people who are enabling the North. And in fact, we heard from Gordon Chang in a program the center sponsored yesterday, frequent guest on this program, of course, about the magnitude of the support the Chinese are providing, not just in terms of food and fuel and other kinds of material assistance, but in terms of their ability to threaten this country with transporter reactor launchers and missile canisters and perhaps missiles as well. They may not be the only ones doing that, but Fred, give us your sense of the current status of this challenge posed by North Korea and its enablers.
Well, first, I thought the president's speech to the South Korean parliament was fabulous. It laid out the threat in excruciating detail, not just the threat from North Korea's missile and nuclear programs, but the horrendous human rights situation, noting that living in North Korea is like a living hell. And that's what we want our leaders to be doing. And Barack Obama just never did that. That's the world knew they could walk all over Barack Obama. And I think he made a real difference. The president did. In Seoul when he gave his speech. And it's interesting to see all these liberal commentators faulting the president for calling out North Korea. And they had nothing to say when Barack Obama gave the North a pass. I see signs that the Chinese are finally starting to crack down on sanctions. I don't know that they're going to work, but my position is before we consider military action, we have to go down every peaceful avenue. And I think the president made the case to the Chinese, North Korea is a threat to you. This test site where they're testing these underground nuclear devices in North Korea, it could collapse, releasing an enormous amount of radiation. And as much as the Chinese want to use North Korea as a proxy to undermine us, I think there could be a new dynamic in play here. I mean, I'm not sure that's the case, but I think we have to be hopeful.
Well, and I think we need to pursue it aggressively with the Chinese to make sure they understand, as Gordon was arguing yesterday and does on our program with regularity, that the costs of continuing to engage in this kind of behavior with the North Koreans is going to always be higher than they can stand. And that's where we need to get to, it seems to me. You have noted in a recent piece about the president's speech in South Korea that it was reminiscent of one that your old boss John Bolton made back in 2003. I only wish that the policies that John had advocated then had been followed in the interval. We might not have the problem we have today had that been done.
Ambassador Bolton also gave a great speech when he was Undersecretary for Arms Control in 2003. What I tried to explain in my Washington Times column was that both President Trump and Mr. Bolton both gave tough speeches in North Korea. Bolton's went nowhere because the swamp undermined him at every turn, because the bureaucracy, the State Department that dealt with East Asia and the Pacific were all careerists. We didn't call them swamp creatures then, but that's what they were, Frank.
That, unfortunately, is what they are today, too, indeed. Hey, Fred, let me quickly turn to two other topics. You have been following, I know closely, this Uranium-1 scandal. The real collusion with the Russians, not to be confused with what still remains, it seems to me, mostly, if not entirely, a will of the wisp, the alleged one involving the Trump campaign with the Putin regime. I'd like to hear what your current reading is on that, but also, if I could, just impress upon our listeners that this is not the only example of such collusion to the detriment of our national security and, well, it must be said, the benefit of the Clinton Foundation and therefore the Clintons personally. There's also this matter of Skolkovo, this so-called Silicon Valley that the Clinton and Obama folks were determined to try to build for the Russians near Moscow by transferring immense amount of very sensitive, obviously in some cases at least, dual-use technology like hypersonic missile technology now being unfortunately deployed by the Russians to threaten us. Your thoughts?
Well, I've been focusing on, and I'm writing today, on something that Shepard Smith said on Fox News this week, that there's nothing to this Uranium-1 story because a 9-member board allowed the Uranium-1 sale to go through, and Clinton says she wasn't involved. But Frank, you and I know the way these things work. If a major player on a board like this wants something to happen, it happens. Now, the Clinton Foundation had enormous conflicts of interest with Uranium-1, receiving over $100 million in contributions to the Clinton Foundation, a $500,000 contribution from a bank that was lobbying Bill Clinton on the Uranium-1 deal. At a minimum, Hillary Clinton should have declared this and recused herself from this decision. The idea that, well, I wasn't involved, it just doesn't add up. This obviously is at least a serious ethics problem, if not a situation to put our national security at risk.
And not least because we've had increasingly evidence that Eric Holder's Justice Department, Robert Mueller personally, were aware of criminal activity that was going on in connection with this transaction and said nothing about it. I have to believe that was in order not to interfere with it because, well, I think Hillary Clinton was keen to see it completed. Fred, just very quickly, your thoughts on this technology transfer business. We've seen the Clintons do this in the past with the Chinese MIRVing their missiles, as a matter of fact. Would this be true to form?
I think it's true to form. It just shows the failure to have a national security mindedness, to realize things like this really can hurt our national security. And I think it reflects the greed of the Clintons, the greed of the Clinton foundations to just do anything to advance their power and their finances.
Fred Flights, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for your long and distinguished and continuing service to our country at the Center for Security Policy these days. We're very proud of you and look forward to talking with you again next week. Next up, Michael Daugherty, one of the men on the cutting edge of cybersecurity these days and the threats there too, joins us next, right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's a pleasure to say, joined by Mike Daugherty. He is the CEO of LabMD, but he also, as a result of his experiences with LabMD, has become well an authority on matters involving the cyber warfare business, having been subjected to it a bit himself. He has recently joined the board of the National Cybersecurity Society and is also a member of the board of directors of NetShield Corporation. He is a guy that we've turned to in the past and are happy to do so again to discuss some of the subjects that he's written about in his terrific book, Devil Inside the Beltway, the shocking expose of the U.S. government's surveillance and overreach into cybersecurity, medicine, and small business. Michael, welcome back. I'm glad to have you with us.
Well, thank you, sir. Good to be here.
There's so much to talk about in this domain. I'd hardly know where to begin. Perhaps I could ask you about one of the authorities that gives the U.S. government the opportunity, the ability, the license, some might say, to engage in surveillance, perhaps overreaching surveillance in the cybersecurity space. Namely, this section of the law known as 702. It is being debated at the moment, and there seems to be a likelihood that it will be watered down in important respects. I'd like your thoughts on that, if you could.
702 was passed right around 9/11, when everyone was in a rare time of complete unification and filled with fear and anxiety. So it was you could railroad, so to speak, although there wasn't a lot of pushback at the time, over giving absolutely massive power to the government and surveillance and privacy violations or potential, not even violating it anymore, just basically giving them the power and the legal authority to dig in as broad as they can under the broad guise of national security. And big shock to nobody. It got abused in some people's opinion because the last decade, especially with the Obama administration, the American people's trust in the government has been so violated that no one thinks the government has the self-regulatory capability to not abuse the power it's been given. And that is when you, that's due to things like what was found during WikiLeaks release and the behavior of the government that shows absolutely no accountability to anyone inside the government when they violate the law, if they're a politico or a bureaucrat or anyone that's known at all. So that has created a violation of trust. So now people want to rein back the power. And it's creating quite a tension because, of course, everyone in the law enforcement side of the NSA and the CIA and all that and the FBI and the DOJ, they think, look, we're absolutely trustworthy. Of course we should have all this power and all this clout. And then they scream national security. But the problem is, a few bad apples have ruined it for everybody, and the public really doesn't like that clout. So we have to make a decision of how much we're going to rein in the people that are supposed to be protecting us.
Right. Michael, let me ask you, this has come to a head in part of late because of the so-called unmasking of American citizens by the Obama administration, in a way that seemed to smack of politically motivated surveillance and the defamation, in fact, of some of these American citizens as a result of releasing information that should not have been in the public domain. Are you generally on the side of those who would say, look, scrap Section 702, avoid all of this kind of potential for abuse in the future, or is there some middle ground that we ought to be striving for?
And see, I think that is the unfortunate result of not holding people accountable. My solution would be go after the people that violated it, show the American people that anyone that violates 702 is going to have a consequence to pay, and then they'd get their power back. So my choice would be when someone, these people in the Obama administration had a political opinion that they thought was so right that they thought they were above the law, and they're conscious of it and absolutely fine with it. And when you set a stage, when everyone gets the message that you can break the law if you're in the right part of the White House and you're not going to be held accountable, this sends a terrible message. And so that's the way to fix it. Now, if that's not going to happen, then yeah, you got to rein in 702, which means we all pay the price, because then the policemen are going to have less tools to keep us safe.
And I want to talk about that specifically, because it is a concern that I feel very strongly from a sort of national security background. We're watching all of this play out, it must be said, at the same time that we've had yet another devastating, apparently, attack on the cybersecurity of the National Security Agency, the organization that does this kind of surveillance for us, including, apparently, the compromise, now the disclosure on the web itself of the tools, at least some of the tools, very sensitive, very strategically important tools at that, that NSA has used to get into hostile computer systems and otherwise work their magic. As a cybersecurity, specialist now, Michael Daugherty, what are your thoughts on the implications of this latest hack of the NSA itself and what comes of it?
Well, this is, again, the fruit of the poisonous tree, being the bad behavior of the U.S. government, so no one trusts it, so they people get restricted. And then you have Julian Assange taking the tools away from the very people trying to protect us. I mean, most of the people at the NSA are good apples. You have very few bad apples. But when the bad apples are at the top, they're the problem. So this demoralizing of morale is understandable when this is happening, when they're getting attacked from all over. Because what the public doesn't understand is everybody's vulnerable, including the NSA, to insider threats and hacking. And when there's no support for the ground troops, that's a demoralizing issue, and there's no accountability for bad apples. If you're a good apple and you work there and you see a bad apple getting away with everything, it is demoralizing.
My concern, though, I have to say, Michael, is it seems as though some of the bad apples, at least, have not been at the top necessarily. There may be some there, too, but you know, some of them are low-level folks, even contractors who aren't even employees of the agency, but the compromises have been devastating nonetheless. Let me ask you about one other issue before we run out of time here. Again, our guest is Michael Daugherty of LabMD and the National Cybersecurity Society. There is a report now that a former NSA official by the name of William Binney has come to the conclusion that the leaks of emails out of the Democratic National Committee was an inside job, not a Russian hack. And therefore, much of the theory of the case that there was some terrible collusion going on that involved the Russians with the Trump campaign against the Democrats is, you know, a house of cards, shall we say. Your assessment of all of that?
That's perfectly plausible, because it is one of the number one threats in all cyber leaks in all large organizations. So it would absolutely fit the pattern. It would be an inside threat. And here's what happens. When moral people, and most people are moral, see immorality, some of them will actually report it, because it's going to make themselves mock. You're seeing Donna Brazile go crazy right now with her book, because she just about had it with the Clintons. And it's sort of that in a much smaller vein. It wouldn't surprise me at all, but here's the problem. How much media is it going to get? What's going to happen? Because the press has put so much vested in this Russian hot air thing.
Among others, it's the press, of course, the Democrats have as well. And it does raise a question as to whether we will ever get actually to the ground truth here. Let me just say, Michael, we are out of time, but I wanted to say how much I appreciate your work in this space. And it's a fascinating story how you came to it as a result of some cyber operations against your company. And it's a cautionary tale for all of us, whether our information is in the Office of Management and Budgets coffers or Home Depot's or somebody else's. It's a frightening time to be watching tools being compromised, national security capabilities of our government being abused and therefore perhaps lost as well. I hope you'll come back to us for further conversations about this, Michael. In the meantime, thank you so much for joining us today and for the work you're doing at the National Cybersecurity Society and elsewhere. Come back to us again soon. Next up, we'll talk with Adam Credo about what's going on in the Middle East and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by Adam Credo, one of the most intrepid and, I think, most important correspondents, reporters, analysts, commentators, if you will, on matters involving foreign and national security policy. These days, he is a writer for the Washington Free Beacon. I consider it to be an indispensable online resource, not least because of his great work there, as well as our friend and colleague Bill Gertz. I'm also reminded of some of the work that he's been doing in the past in organizations like the Jewish Telegraphic Agency and the Jerusalem Post, because it has informed much of his insights into an important part of his beat, namely the Middle East. Adam Credo, it's so good to have you. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, I want to start with the Middle East because you've been doing some really important work on focusing attention in a place that I don't think it's getting nearly enough, and that is on what is happening on the ground in Syria in the wake of the combined effort of, well, American air power and the Russians, the Assad regime, the Iranians for sure, to take down the ISIS enclaves there. When you look at this, Adam Credo, what are you seeing in the way of the consolidation of power by Iran in that country and your thoughts on its implications?
Sure. Well, this is part of a larger pursuit by the Iranians. Syria is really one leg, I think, of what it was described to be recently by a member of Congress on the Foreign Affairs Committee, Iranian colonization of the Middle East. And I think that that's an accurate description of what they're up to and what they're trying to do. In Syria, look, it's a matter of establishing bases, establishing a permanent presence there, bolstering relations with the Russians, the Russian Air Force in particular, and bolstering Hezbollah, their terror proxy group that sits on Israel's northern border. And for Iran, Syria obviously is a key place. It gives them essentially that land bridge that they're trying to build from Syria all the way across the Middle East. And that's why we also see them in Iraq. We see the Iranians having a large presence now in Lebanon as the prime minister there resigned. Hezbollah kind of takes over the entire country. And of course, elsewhere that the Iranians are playing around Yemen and other areas.
Yeah, no, you're so right. This is just one place in a larger tableau, shall we say, that is being drawn up by this Iranian mullahocracy. I do wonder, though, Adam, what you make of the prospects that we will see this positioning translate into the next, well, at a minimum, regional conflict between Israel and the Iranians, either their proxies, Hezbollah and others, or the Iranians themselves.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's one this government, the Trump administration, is not looking at closely enough. I think they have their plate full, but they're kind of avoiding the long-term questions that are going to be very important. Look, if we start to combat Iranian influence now in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, certainly in Lebanon, we can avoid what I think is going to be, at the very least, a regional war, and if it spirals out of control, another world war as a result of Iran's influence in the region. We have Hezbollah armed to the teeth on Israel's northern border. They in Israel will not permit this for much longer. We have Iran meddling around in Syria, of course, another location that brings them even closer to the Israelis. And I think the longer this administration neglects actually combating that Iranian influence, the more likely it is that we're going to have a very big conflict in that region down the road.
Adam, you've reported on a seeming bipartisan consensus in the Congress, a very rare thing these days, on precisely this point, that the colonization, if you will, of Syria by Iran is an extremely ominous thing, and calling for the Trump administration to take steps to counter that. Tell us a little bit about who's behind that and the value you think might attach to that initiative.
Absolutely. I think this is very important, and I found it particularly interesting when I came across this letter. This is nearly 50 members of Congress in the House lawmakers, but a very large bipartisan effort. I mean, I'm talking as far left and far right as you can get. And essentially what they're saying is that after going to the region, they're incredibly concerned about the role Iran is playing in Syria. They're wondering why the Trump administration is not working hard to combat Iran having a permanent military presence there, and what really would be a historic policy shift of allowing another country to expand its military outside of its borders. And it's particularly concerning when it's the Iranians. And of course, the other things like them building weapons factories in Syria that is arming Hezbollah directly. This is helping the Iranians stop shipping missiles because they can actually build them locally for Hezbollah and get them to them more quickly. So all of these things is really forcing these lawmakers to say, we have a major problem here, and we have a major problem that's going to get worse very soon if we don't deal with it now, which kind of harkens back to what I was just saying. And they're asking, very interestingly, they're asking the Trump administration, come to us, come to Congress, and present us with a plan on how to combat the Iranian presence in Syria.
Well, it's overdue, that's for sure. And it's related, I think, to something else you've been reporting on, Adam Credo, at the Washington Free Beacon, namely the aid that we are effectively giving the Iranians, or at least, again, their proxies, the Iranian Shiite militias, for example, and perhaps others as well, either directly or indirectly in the Palestinian areas, as well as, of course, Iraq and Syria. What's being done on that front to try to stop this presumably unintentional support for our enemies?
Well, you know, there's actually a question there. Is it unintentional support? And that's a question that it's a question we'd have to ask the architects of this program, which happen to be people at the State Department that are holdovers from the former administration, officials like Brett McGurk, who's our ISIS czar and, of course, served for 8 years under the Obama administration.
And this was a policy that began during that period, as I understand it, right?
Absolutely correct. The Obama administration's effort to arm Iraqi militia forces that they thought would take on ISIS on their behalf. The problem is a large number of these militias are controlled by Iranian forces, have ties to Hezbollah, have ties to the Badr Corps, have ties certainly to the IRGC, the Quds forces, and the commander there, Soleimani. So I think the Obama administration quite specifically turned a blind eye to this because it was a narrative that did not benefit their policy towards Iran, which was emboldening Iran, enforcing this nuclear agreement. But the Trump administration inherited and has continued this policy of providing money, arms, and training to the Iraqi Ministry of Interior, which has doled out this cash, assistance, training, and weapons to militia fighters that are tied to the Iranians. And we've seen the repercussions of this, them killing and targeting our Kurdish allies. And I think this really has become one of the biggest foreign policy scandals in the region, and nobody really seems to care. And I think that's very sad.
Well, scandals is one aspect of it. Debacle is another way to put it, I think. And it certainly is undermining Americans' interests and, as you say, our allies in that part of the world to our great detriment. Adam Credo, we are too far out of time to address another issue, which I hope we'll get you back on soon to discuss, namely the use of the visa lottery by terrorists. I'm very pleased to say David Bratt, Congressman from Virginia, has introduced legislation, H.R. 4340 to stop that. But this is a subject for a conversation with you, I hope, very soon. Adam Credo, thank you in the meantime for the work you're doing at the Washington Free Beacon and for joining us. Do come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.